Record Spins on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
I'm Steve Scherr. Spirituality is a purposely nebulous term. It indicates a belief in something, but it doesn't give away what those beliefs are or where those beliefs come from. Organized religion is different. Religions can be pegged to a movement or a moment in history, or in some cases to a man. Leslie Hazelton is an award-winning writer, focuses on religion, politics, and history, and she's done extensive work in the Middle East. She wanted to know more about one of those men who sparked an entire faith, the man whose experiences and preaching led to the birth of Islam. Her most recent book is called The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad.
Mecca, at the time Muhammad was born, and he was born an orphan, by the way, which is usually skipped over by most biographers, and I have no idea why. It's totally key to understanding who he was. It placed him on the margins. It gave him that outsider eye which allowed him to see clearly what was happening in Mecca. And Mecca, in the early 7th century, was basically the equivalent of a Wall Street bull market. Money had taken over, and with it, of course, greed and corruption. And when Muhammad started preaching after the first revelation of the Quran, it was essentially a totally subversive message. It was a radical message. It was a radical protest against inequality, injustice, for equality, including, by the way, women's rights. And it was addressed to everybody else, to the 99%. And of course, it aroused great opposition from the 1%, as one might expect.
The reason it was the bull market, explain that.
Mecca was a huge trading hub from the Yemen up to Damascus, which was a major, major city at the time, and on into the Byzantine Empire. And twice a year, they organized these huge trade caravans, 2,000 camels at a time. But at the same time that Mecca was also a trading hub, it was also a hub of pilgrimage because of the Kaaba, the shrine that existed before Muhammad.
The shrine to?
To Allah. Allah was the one supreme, omnipotent God who was beyond all human comprehension, beyond touch, which is why there were all these other sort of minor gods, I call them totem gods, that were being worshipped too, because they were the ones that you could approach, they were the ones that you could sacrifice to, you could make oaths in front of and so on.
The idea of a supreme God over the other gods was already percolating, and that was part of what was happening across the region as well.
Absolutely. Allah is simply the Arabic equivalent of El in Sumeria and in Phoenicia, Elohim in Israel and the Hebrew nomenclature. And again, this idea of one supreme God was not unknown. I mean, it was simply accepted. The issue was all these other sort of associates with God. I mean, imagine, for instance, it's like there's one name on the door of a huge law firm and everybody else is associates, junior partners. And what Muhammad, of course, was preaching was take all those other names out of the equation.
So Muhammad, an orphan, an outsider, but the people who are the 1%, there is a structure in this 1%, the Quraysh?
Quraysh tribe, right.
Who were they and how did they influence what was happening in this world at that time?
They were the ruling tribe of Mecca. And in fact, Muhammad himself was Quraysh, except that he was born really on the margins of the tribe. And thus, he's an outsider within the inside tribe. And as the story of his life goes on, he becomes the absolute outsider. In fact, he gets exiled from Mecca. And then just 8 years later, he returns victorious, acclaimed as the ultimate insider. I mean, it's an amazing story.
Leslie Hazelton is the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. What were your sources?
There are two wonderful sources. One is by Ibn Ishaq, biography of Muhammad, written in the 9th century, The Life of Muhammad. And the other is in rather daunting 40 volumes in English. It's a translation of the history of early Islam by Al-Tabari. And these two sources they're difficult to read for Westerners who are used to linear chronological narrative. They sort of weave back and forth in time and chronology, but they are basically oral histories And they are incredibly inclusive. So you might get 12, even 20 versions of the same event told from different points of view and in different voices.
And as you say, these are either oral histories or first-hand accounts or sometimes children.
Mm-hmm. First-hand accounts passed down through three or four generations. And each time they're very, very careful to give what they call the isnad, which is the chain of communication. Like, I heard this from A, who heard it from B, who heard it from C, who was there when it happened. But where you get the real juice of it, the real vitality of somebody actually talking, is where I'm always looking for.
You have a pretty chilling series where when he first comes down from whatever he's doing up in the mountain.
The first revelation of the plan up on Mount Hira. Imagine, if you can, just a couple of years ago, here I am, this agnostic Jew, puzzling for months on end at what I knew was an unanswerable question, and that is, what actually happened on Mount Hira in the first revelation of the Quran? We have an account of it in Muhammad's words as related by others, and I've given this in the book, but still it's as related by others, and you can see that they're trying to translate the ineffable into concrete images that they can understand, like the angel Gabriel standing inside the horizon and actually speaking and so on. So I've explored this. This is obviously the most speculative part of the book, and I'm sure for some the most presumptuous part. But while many people may call this a fool's errand, I would much rather be a fool for trying than another kind of fool for not trying.
What was it about the words he used that struck the vast majority of people? Because it was his language that first captivated them, right?
It was. And it's very, very hard to capture in English. The musicality, the alliteration, the assonance, the poetry of the original Quranic Arabic. And it was all the more striking coming from him because he was known to be a very, very terse man who only spoke when necessary. He was the last person he expected ever to be a prophet, which is why during that first revelation, he was so sure that he had to be absolutely out of his mind. I mean, his reaction to it is so human and so sane.
What was it?
My God, God is speaking to me. I have to be out of my mind. And he was so afraid that this was so, that his first impulse was to leap off the mountain to his death. And this seems to me so convincingly human that there is no question in my mind that, as some anti-Muslim people maintain, he made it all up. No, that's obviously not so. Something clearly happened that night. Muhammad experienced it, and we have to respect his experience.
Leslie Hazelton's book is The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. When do the revelations, the things he says, when do they become, in your mind, as somebody who's been reading it and studying it, more political, more focused on what revolution he's bringing to the culture?
Well, the various interpretations were political here. Certainly from early on, his message was radical. It was calling for equal distribution of wealth, equal distribution of respect. The level of verbal and physical harassment of both him and his early followers built up to such a degree that it resulted at the end in a sort of concerted attempt on his life, which forced him into exile in Medina. And here I think you have to take the psychology of exile into account. This is where the Quranic revelations, which were ongoing, become much more clearly political. They're concerned with establishing a whole new community of Islam and with the rules for that community and the standards and the norms for that community and so on. They're much more concerned with ongoing events like various battles with Mecca.
Is the language different? Is the poetry still there?
Less so. The earlier, and you can distinguish in the Quran between the earlier, more mystical revelations and the later, more practical ones, because the Quran was, the chapters were arranged by length, with the longest ones first and the shortest ones at the end. And as a general rule, what this means is that the longer ones tend to be the more openly political, practical ones, which were the later ones, and the shorter ones, which are towards the end, are the more mystical ones. So in a way, without any disrespect, if someone wants to understand the appeal of the Quran to those early listeners, in a way it's best if they begin at the back and read it as though it were still in Arabic from right to left, because those shorter chapters at the end are much more mystical.
All right, I want to ask you about violence and how Islam evolved. And after a while, the character, the person of Muhammad in this book, I mean, is part of a historical flow of events. Mm-hmm. Like the massacre of the Korez,
mm-hmm.
this was a Jewish tribe.
Mm-hmm.
What did that event tell you about where Muhammad was going and where, I don't know if the same thing is true, where Islam was going?
When Muhammad first went to Medina, there were three Jewish tribes in Medina, but they were very much the minority there. And I think when he got there, he expected wholehearted support from them. I mean, his prophets were their prophets. One third of the Quran is basically a reprise of biblical stories, mainly from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Bible. And it seemed natural that these monotheists would support him, but it's as though he hadn't taken into account that, so far as they were concerned, the age of prophecy had ended with the exile in Babylon, and they weren't ready for a new prophet, especially one who wasn't himself Jewish. So there was a certain tension already there, and then they were under the protection of one of his main political opponents in Medina. So basically, those tribes, I think, became, as it were, the pawns in a power struggle. But also, and I think far more important, is that this is where early Islam begins to differentiate itself from what you might call its parent faith, which was Judaism, just as Christianity had to differentiate itself from its parent faith, which was also Judaism. It had to establish its own separate identity. What happened with the Quraysh tribe, there are many, many, many versions, and some historians have called this the break with the Jews. I think that's oversimplifying grossly. But yes, some kind of break had to occur. But I think it has to be read in context.
All right, well, let me ask you this last question. We won't need to sum up the entire faith or how it works in the world today, but I'm curious about how you feel you have learned from having done this research on the first Muslim.
Wow, it's pretty hard to say after you've lived with somebody, as it were, as a writer for 4 or 5 years and then written 100,000 words to boil it down to what you have learned. I was just delighted to realize that I'd actually done what I had set out to do, which was to see Muhammad whole, to see him in full, to accord him the integrity and respect of a full life lived. He came alive on the page for me, and I hope he does for other people too.
Writer Leslie Hazelton, author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. You can find a link to the entire interview at kuow.org. It's The Record with Marcy Summon. I'm Steve Scherr.